On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We promise, we swear, it will not be all politics all the time here. But just for today, with the midterm thumping behind us and the 08 presidential race already coming up like thunder, we're going to peek ahead with two big analysts at what it takes to win the White House these days. Bill Clinton defined one big centrist approach. George Bush and Karl Rove defined another of working the hard core, the base. Now Hillary Clinton and John McCain and Barack Obama and Sam Brownback and more have decisions to make. Early decisions about navigating the circus and secrets of the White House winning trade that winners share. Up next on Point, Mark Halperin and John Harris on the way to win in 08 and who's got the stuff and strategy. We will be joined in this hour by the authors of a big new book on the looming race. It's called The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. Joining me first here in studio is ABC political director, ABC News political director, Mark Halperin. He's co-author of The Way to Win. Mark, great to have you here.
Tom, thanks. Nice to be here.
I hope we'll be joined in a moment from Washington by John Harris. We're also joined in this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mark.
Here it is. It's the only a Monday morning of the week after the week that was, and it was a huge one. And you and John Harris are all over the place, Mark Halperin, talking about the way to win in 08. I can imagine a lot of listeners thinking, oh, my gosh, give us a break here. But we want to look ahead for a minute because the lay of the land is getting laid out very quickly here. What about it? You've got a big thesis here, and we'll unpack it on what to learn from Clinton, what to learn from Bush and Rove. But did last week blow a lot of this away? I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom now, Rove, not a genius. Bush, not a winner. Hillary Clinton, not the darling. The freak show, as you described the media circus, not the determinant. So does your case stand?
Well, I think it does, Tom. You know, when we started the book, it was right after President Bush's reelection, Senator John Kerry having gone down in a race that many thought Bush could not win. People were fascinated, as were we, by this question, not just of what Bush and Rove knew about the way to win, but also this dynastic pattern of Bush's and Clinton's. Why do these two families dominate our politics? We anticipated, as we rode along, it became clear that Bush and Rove were doing less well. If you look at the Bush record and the Clinton record, they're now going to be mirror images. Both of them will have won two presidential elections, defied history in one midterm election, and had a very disastrous midterm. So what we say in The Way to Win is you can learn a lot from the successes of the Bushes and the Clintons and of Karl Rove. You can also learn from their failures about the way to lose.
So you give us the trade secrets of an era when you say Richard Nixon's old advice was out the window and it was time to think anew, think afresh. But are you saying that era lasts beyond last Tuesday? Did last Tuesday mark a new beginning, or are we still in the kind of stew pot that brought us Clinton, brought us Bush?
I think we're still in that same stew pot. And again, what we argue in the book is the person who is as well positioned as anyone else to be the next president is Hillary Clinton, sort of a hybrid. Her political leanings are similar to her husband. She's learned a lot from him, but her political operation is attuned to the current environment. You mentioned what we call it, the freak show. The current environment that will prevail in 2008 is one in which many of the Bush-Rove tactics, which did not work perfectly by any means in the midterms just passed, many of these tactics and strategies will still be essential for the winner in 2008. And Hillary Clinton's learned a lot of them already.
What is the freak show? You describe it as the defining environment for presidential politics in America. A lot of talk again about last week deciding or showing something new, voters kind of moving past the easy polarization, thinking about the center, not wanting to be manipulated, looking squarely at some problems, i.e. Iraq, among others. What's the freak show, and does it still prevail, Mark?
It very much still prevails, and clearly the Iraq war, you know, you don't have controlled experiments in politics, so clearly the Iraq war is the defining element of this election. It's the defining element now of the Bush administration, but you see in our politics still Republicans having a bit of a comeback when John Kerry made a remark that was used by Republicans very effectively using their freak show tactics. Look, American politics has always had extreme voices in it. It's always had partisan attacks and rough rhetoric. What's different now, what has prevailed during the Clinton and Bush years and will prevail in 2008, we say in The Way to Win, is the way these extreme voices are now at the center of our politics. Michael Moore and Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Matt Drudge, these are highly influential people who affect not only the new media environments in which they operate, but also the old media. They're so pervasive, and it is using information as a weapon rather than having an informed debate. This kind of program that we're talking on now is much different than the kind of rhetoric that dominates presidential politics and will in 2008.
Jack Beatty, we'll dive into the theory of the case here, the trade secrets that Mark Alpern and John Harris bring us. But what about the big picture here, Jack? Do you see the same political dynamic sort of rolling on into 08 that's dominated American politics for a couple of decades now, or do you see something new coming out of last Tuesday's vote?
Well, I hope there's something new coming out of it. We are not an aristocracy. This idea of dynasties going on, this is not our way. So I hope that we're not going to see the Clinton reprise. But, you know, I, with all due respect, I agree that campaign tactics and electioneering are diverting and important. But really, what reelected George Bush in 2004 was the attack of 2001. That presidentialized him. And the fear that most voters had about another attack and the fact that we hadn't had one. That just seems to me to be inarguable. All the tactics in the world couldn't come up, couldn't match up against that historical fact. Second, this election we've just said, as Mark said, is all about the war and the albatross of that. And all the tactics in the world, all the freak showing and all the manipulation and all the propaganda couldn't change that. These are big things. These are matters of history, not of tactics. And I really think those are the things that elect presidents much more than these tactics.
And yet, elections are won at the margins. And John Kerry came close and it made a difference who got that last few votes. Mark Alpern, begin to lay it out for us. You say, if you want to win, look at Clinton, look at Bush, learn from their trade secrets, begin to open your playbook for us. What are you talking about?
Well, look, liberals have looked at Karl Rove and George Bush and said these guys are evil and ruthless. And the reason they succeeded in three straight national elections is because they're willing to do things that most people aren't. A lot of conservatives have looked at Bill Clinton and said this guy is slick. This guy is a politician of a generation. There's nothing to learn from him unless you could somehow find that magic potion that he was baptized with. The reality is that the Clintons and the Bushes, these extended political families, they look to each other. They study each other. They respect each other.
As much as they disparage one another.
Correct.
In most forums.
Correct. They see each other as the winners. And our book opens at the Clinton Library dedication right after John Kerry lost to George Bush. And these families looked at each other up on that stage and said, we are the winners. Bill Clinton, we interviewed him for the book. We interviewed Karl Rove. You know, you said this is the advice. The advice in the book is not from John Harrison, from me. The advice is from Bill Clinton, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, their associates who we talked to. They don't agree on what America should be like in terms of government. They do agree on the way to win. And as I said, what positions Hillary Clinton so well, we argue in the book, is she has learned the lessons from both political families and in some ways has built a more efficient and ruthless political operation than Bill Clinton ever dreamed of.
So you can hear the resistance already in a way to the whole idea of trade secrets around winning the White House. We want to think of it as a national sacrament, a kind of, a seeking truth and wisdom. You say that's there. You've got to have the substance. You've got to bring some truth to the table. But the tricks and of the trade matter. Open each of these two chapters. And so Clinton, Bush, what are the messages
right.
that they're reading off each other's playbooks?
Look, we tried to write a book. We did write a book to describe the way things are rather than the way things ought to be. We don't celebrate the freak show. We don't celebrate Matt Drudge's influence and his website, The Drudge Report. We just describe the way we think it is and talking to political professionals on both sides. Ideas matter in politics. We have a chapter on ideas. Bill Clinton in 1992, George Bush in 2000 were the most thoughtful candidates about what they wanted to do to change the country of anyone else in the field. Ideas are the enemy of the freak show, but the freak show is also the enemy of ideas. And this media political system you have to run in now is just – it's a harsh system, but it's the one that's going to prevail. There are two big schools of thought, though, and this goes to the midterm elections. The area where the Clintons and the Bushes most diverge, they have a lot of tactical similarities. We can talk about those. But the Bush theory of politics is to divide the country, to say the country's already divided. There are big issues to fight about. We should fight about them. And if you want to change the country fundamentally, either in a conservative direction or a liberal direction, you got to be willing to do that. Clinton politics is different. And it says bring the country together, celebrate and emphasize the things where the country is united, and try to lower the rhetoric. That is more likely to unite the country, although Clinton had trouble doing it for other reasons. but it also is less likely to bring fundamental change.
Is the base strategy, the polarizing Bush strategy that you described, less likely to be wielded for 08 given last week's election outcome?
There's no question now that every candidate's asking themselves that question. And the front runners, Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, John McCain on the Republican side, we made clear in The Way to Win, they're both Clinton politics candidates. They both are politicians who have thrived by looking for bipartisan compromise, even though they're somewhat polarizing figures, particularly Hillary Clinton. The problem is, the reason that Bush politics still looks appealing, particularly to the Republicans, is Bush got elected on it in 2004, and all the pressures in politics from political media, from fundraising, from the Capitol Hill caucuses and conferences, all of that pushes someone towards the extreme and the polarized.
And tricks of the trade, does it mean dirty tricks?
Some of them do, but people who look at Karl Rove in particular and say he's succeeded because he's engaged in evil politics, first of all, there's almost no evidence for most of the things he's accused of. You know, people say he destroyed John McCain. Well, whatever destroyed John McCain, there's no evidence anyone's brought forward that Karl Rove did it. Same with the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth that took down John Kerry.
Let's listen to this little bit from September 18th, Bill Clinton making an appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Mr. President, Hillary Clinton may be running for president. If so, what is the key to defeating her? Your move!
Getting more votes.
Getting more votes. Is she running for president?
I don't know. She's not now running for president, and I don't know. I don't know if she will or not. I know that I don't, and that's the truth. And I think I would know if she were, if she decided.
There'd be a Post-it probably on the fridge.
Yeah, you know, we talked last night a long time about Ann Richards and about her book being reissued. We talked about a lot of things. Unbelievable. I loved her very much, and so did Hillary. But I don't know. I know this. If she did run and win, she'd be great. She'd be really good. I do not know if she's going to run. I don't know if she'll win if she does. But if she ran and won, it'd be good for America. That's what I believe.
Bill Clinton talking about Hillary Clinton maybe running. Mark Halpern's with us, co-author of The Way to Win. Mark, you say Hillary Clinton brings a kind of hybrid package, learning from Bill's playbook and the Bush-Rove playbook. Describe that for us. Why do you think she's in the leading Democrat right now?
Well, look, she's a very polarizing figure, but the last two guys who got elected president are polarizing figures. She would have to do what George Bush did in 2004, make this a choice election. If it's a referendum on Hillary Clinton, I agree she probably can't win. But when she's up against other Democrats, if she's the nominee of the party, she's up against Republican in a referendum, not a referendum, but a choice, she can win. You look at her political standing, her political image in the 1990s, she was a disaster. She was attacked all the time. She had no control of her public image. She did not have an organized political machine to protect her and to attack her enemies. She's got all that now. You look at her Senate career in Washington, a model senator. Even her enemies, even her opponents will say she's been a great senator in terms of constituent service. Look at how she works across the aisle. She does work with Newt Gingrich on health care. She does work with John McCain on all sorts of issues. She's done work with Tom Coburn, the conservative Republican from Oklahoma. So she has learned better to control her public image. And in terms of dealing with the freak show, she is now, her staff says, a warrior. This, she's attacked less than she used to be, but still a lot. But she's learned how to deal
with
it.
Is that a warrior or worrier?
Warrior. W-A. It's my Maryland accent.
Ready to go to war.
W-A-R-R-I-O-R. She is tough. She's battle-tested. And if you look at the Rove operation that he's put together and her strategist, it is much more efficient. She has much more loyalty from her staff, just like George Bush and Karl Rove. She has an operation that uses the freak show to attack her opponents rather than waiting to be attacked. She also, though, goes with a lot of the things that Bush and Clinton both have done. For instance, run to your weakness. Confront your weakness head on, something that John Kerry and Al Gore did not understand.
What does that mean in Hillary Clinton's case?
Well, she's got to figure out what her party is weak on, what she is personally considered weak on, and confront it. So, for instance, she's going to have to confront the Iraq War to win the Democratic nomination. But in the general election, her party is going to have to deal with the deficiencies, despite the midterm results, the deficiencies on national security and on faith. Two bars that John Kerry did not help his party reach, she's going to have to confront those. And I predict if she runs, she will try to.
Jack Beatty, the words that Mark Halpern and John Harris say were associated with Hillary Clinton in the 90s, arrogant, power-hungry, corrupt, harsh, hypocritical, liberal. Now they say she's worked her way to competent, thoughtful, hardworking, determined, principled role model. Can she do it, Jack?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that these things are... For one thing, this business of the public image, they talk about that in their book. Politicians can't control their public image. Those who do are successful. Those who don't lose. But, you know, Harris and Halpern have been conducting a kind of debate with each other in Slate magazine. And in one of these remarks, Harris says something, I think, that really shows us why politicians can't control the public image, and I find it quite a remarkable admission. He said, our professional habits and style book rules sometimes inhibit us, the media, from telling the truth and from saying that someone is lying in plain conversational language. We let it become a matter of controversy whether it is sunny or raining, when sometimes it is a matter of fact. This is one area of the liberal critique of the old media that is often pretty compelling. I think that's the real problem right there, that these things are surfaced in the freak show, all sorts of wild claims, and that the so-called old media reporters can't say it's raining when it's raining. Instead, they say, well, some people think this about John Kerry's record in Vietnam, whereas these other indubitable witnesses from wherever say this. So you figure it out, readers. And I think that's a real damning admission on Harris's part, and one that I think we all have to watch out for as we go into this.
Mark Halpern, you and John Harris write extensively about just this in the book, but do you see, with the challenges growing in front of the American people, economic war, you name it, are the chips down now in a new way? Will people want to be told if it's sunny or raining and not tolerate the kind of fudgy, you know, ambiguity
sure.
in the middle?
John and I are interested in covering American politics, the American people. Unfortunately, to cover American presidential politics today, you must write about the media. And we do in The Way to Win. Conservatives are unhappy with the media. Liberals are unhappy with the media, what we call the old media. What we often say is one of the only optimistic things we can say about the capacity of the American people to unite is in their hatred of the old media.
But you say conservatives have grown a lot less unhappy and liberals more unhappy in recent years.
Well, that's right. I think there's two reasons conservatives are less unhappy than they used to be. One is that they found through the new media a way to reach people directly in order to get their message across, not just through things like the Drudge Report and Fox News Channel and Rush Limbaugh, but also by having those entities infect the coverage of the old media. The other reason they're less unhappy is the old media is weakened. You know, again, we're describing not what we wish were true, but what is currently, which is old media organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC News, we're just not as strong as we used to be. Economically, we have an uncertain future. Editorially, we're more apt to question ourselves in both a positive and negative way than we used to be. And that has let conservatives move much more aggressively in the current era, again, where old media is now in some ways dependent on and subordinate to this new media.
So we may get pulled right back into the blender of charge and countercharge. Of course, how different candidates respond and use and play that game or don't is a big issue. Let's listen. Here's Illinois Senator Barack Obama, much in the news lately, comes in now right behind Hillary Clinton in terms of Democratic presidential preferences, according to a CNN poll. It's not surprising, therefore, that he was much in demand on the congressional campaign trail in the past few weeks. Among the Democratic candidates he stumped for, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow and Governor Jennifer Granholm both won re-election bids. Here's Barack Obama in Detroit last month.
I have been traveling all across the country now for the last couple of weeks, and I won't be traveling for the remaining 3 weeks. In fact, in the last week, I've been in New York, Miami, Kansas City, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Cleveland, Columbus, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Camden, Newark, Trenton, Providence, and now I'm in Detroit. And tonight I'm going home, and I'm hoping that the locks aren't changed on my house.
Barack Obama on the campaign trail, maybe a new kind of figure here, we'll ask. Let's listen to our listeners. Natalie's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Natalie. What do you see out there?
Hi. I was was one of the people, one of probably a couple, maybe a thousand or more people, who saw Barack Obama here in Iowa City a week ago last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge crowd. It was kids and grown-ups and Republicans and Democrats. And people were crazy to see that man. And it was a very inspirational speech. I was very impressed with the man. But I'm tired of people saying that Hillary's the front runner because she has a great machine. The greatest machine in the world is not going to do you any good if you don't have support. Hillary was not in Iowa because I think they knew that she wouldn't draw a crowd. I'm a Democrat. I know lots of Democrats. I'm in a heavily Democratic community, and there's not any support for Hillary, at least that I know of.
And Natalie, let me ask you, do you see Barack Obama as playing the Bill Clinton, George Bush, Karl Rove game or playing a new game?
He's playing an entirely new game, partly because he's had the luxury of it. He hasn't had a whole lot of opposition. But his approach is much different. I mean, I don't know what he would do if he started getting some of the freak show politics thrown at him.
Mark Halpern, pick it up. Natalie says, hey, who says Hillary is the front runner? And we've got a new game with an actor like Barack Obama in it.
I'm always willing to be open to new things, and I think Natalie is onto something here, onto several things. First of all, there are tens of millions of Americans who hate Hillary Clinton and don't want her to be president. Most people who run for president don't start out with that problem. Hillary Clinton needs to win some of those tens of millions back, but not all of them, to be elected. She has the ability to raise money. That is part of presidential politics. One of the things that Barack Obama is considering now as he decides whether to run is his staff is sitting around saying, all right, if he enters this race, can he raise money? He is well aware of the freak show. And one of the other things they're thinking about, and he made reference to this in an interview a few weeks ago, is how would he react? What is there in his background that might be brought up, both in the Democratic fight and in a general election? I think he is a formidable candidate for a lot of reasons. I take him very seriously as a candidate. I think part of his intelligence is, although he's never run before, although he's relatively new to national politics, he understands American politics really well, as does George Bush, as does Bill Clinton.
Does Barack Obama have a kind of freak show Teflon? And can a candidate, an unusual candidate like Barack Obama, be a game changer?
Well, look at John McCain, who was also very popular with the media, who also had this broad-based appeal of talking in a different way like Obama. When he was in the heat of a presidential election in 2000, the freak show destroyed him. We chronicle in the book how even John McCain, someone with a lot of support in the old media, could be destroyed by the freak show, as he was when he ran against George Bush.
Jack Beatty, you hear it bubbling out there already. Chris Matthews, not long ago, pointing out Barack Obama's middle name, Hussein. There's a surprise, brings a kind of different facet to the diamond. And here's this dazzling guy, but there's always some way to stick a needle in. Do you see him as a game changer, Jack?
I don't know. I mean, I think that one thing that's appealing about him is he's not of my generation. He's not a baby boomer. And thank heaven. You know, I mean, we have occupied the the center stage for so long, and all the quarrels going back to the 60s and all the are you with us on Vietnam or against us and all the cultural stuff, that whole business is to him foreign. He says, what is all that about? And he seems to want to close that chapter, whereas, of course, Hillary Clinton keeps it going, keeps the 60s divisions going. I think we have to put that behind us. We have to go on to something new. He generationally represents that. He also represents it intellectually in that he speaks of let's get away from ideological politics and talk practically. So I find him hopeful in that regard.
But still plenty of candidates who want to ride the cultural divide. Let's listen to one Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, also expected to announce a run for the White House. He's a favorite with the Christian conservatives, in part because of his fierce opposition to embryonic stem cell research. Here's Senator Brownback making his case before the U.S. Senate last summer.
This is a particular person, a young girl named Hannah that I just met with a few hours ago. This was when she was adopted as a frozen embryo. This shows her kind of development taking place. You destroy her here, you don't get her here. That's key. And she was, she called a snowflake. Adopted frozen embryos. I hope some people that are maybe watching or hear about this, that they have frozen embryos, human embryos, that they consider putting them up for adoption.
Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, Mark Halpern, there's the culture warrior, very much attached to the Christian right, and no compunction about it, and probably ready to run on it. What does last week's vote tell us about these culture war issues and whether they're still going to be good surfboards for presidential candidates?
Well, Tom, I think it's up to a lot of these Republican candidates to decide, do they want to run on Bush politics, as we say, in the way to win? It certainly is something that is more likely to be done by conservatives than by liberals. There are more conservatives in this country by most measurements than there are liberals. Conservatives seem to be more comfortable doing those kinds of divisions. We'll see if Sam Brownback gets enough traction or if the two dominant candidates right now, John McCain or Governor Romney, decide to go in that direction.
Let's hear another little bit from more of a moderate Republican, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Lots of talk about him and the presidency after 9/11, so of course some time has passed. He was on the campaign trail the past few months, stumping for Republican congressional candidates. At a rally for Senator Jim Talent last month in Missouri, he enlisted humor to try to sway the crowd.
I'm here on behalf of a United States senator who is someone I really, really admire. Different in New York City. In New York City, you hear sirens in the background.
There we are, out in the heartland. The big train coming, but is it coming for Rudy Giuliani, Mark, and maybe the Schwarzenegger school, the moderate Republican, the centrist?
Well, look, when George Bush ran in 2000, as I said before, he did what Bill Clinton did when he ran in 1992. He took on his party and said, my party's wrong on X. You would have been shocked if you'd said in 1990 that the Democrats would have nominated someone who was pro-welfare reform, pro-death penalty, pro-right to work. Bill Clinton took that on. George Bush took on education, took on immigration. It is a difficult thing to do. I think the Republican nominee will have to take on, as will the Democratic nominee, to be successful, because the country likes that, some of the party's positions that are maybe too far to one side or the other. But Rudy Giuliani has a lot of very liberal positions. It is hard for me to see the Republican Party nominating someone with the positions he has on things like guns and abortion and gay rights, but we shall see.
And McCain and the Republican primary, can he make it through that thicket?
I think people overstate the extent of his remaining problem with conservatives in his party. Just like with Hillary Clinton, there are many people in John McCain's party who do not want to see him nominated. But he doesn't need to win them all to be the nominee. And I think a lot of the former Bush people, particularly fundraisers, particularly some of the Washington elites, I think have now been won over to the thought that John McCain is not just conservative enough for them, but is their best chance for winning the general election.
Here's a voice from the last election, very likely to be heard in the hubbub around the next one, way before Hurricane Katrina pushed the issue of poverty back into America's headlines. Former Democratic Senator John Edwards was talking about it. He's expected to run for president on the issue. In a speech to the National Press Club last summer, he called for the elimination of poverty in the U.S. over the next 30 years.
I'm not talking about just giving handouts to the poor. And I'm not talking about pumping money into government programs that don't work. What we have to do is we have to find a way to help people who work be able to support themselves, to help make work pay. So if we're going to have the kind of country that all of us believe in, we can't look the other way. I don't think America wants to look the other way. I don't think you want to look the other way. It's wrong when we have 37 million people living in poverty who are separated from the extraordinary opportunities that ought to be available in our country. Poverty is the great moral issue of our time.
Mark Halperin, Kerry Edwards was the ticket last time, so pick that one apart. John Kerry and then John Edwards. Here, still on poverty and maybe inequality. How do you handicap him?
Well, let me take John Edwards first. I think he's had as strong a year in 2006 as any of the Democrats. Until Barack Obama emerged as a possible candidate, I thought Edwards was the strongest alternative to Hillary Clinton. As you and I discussed before we went on the air, he's had great efforts this year with labor unions, a huge part of the Democratic Party coalition. He's also traveled a lot. It was not unnoticed in the Clinton camp when a poll came out in Iowa showing Edwards first ahead of Hillary Clinton, the first poll of any significance nationally or in a key state showing Hillary Clinton behind another Democrat. I think he's very well positioned. We'll have to see how much money he can raise, again, a reality of presidential politics. And as we write in The Way to Win, last time when he ran, before he was on the ticket, he showed some weaknesses in areas that are important, including having a substantive agenda. Poverty is an area he's talked about. We'll see how much he can fill out the substance part, which is a key part even during in the freak show. John Kerry, we have a chapter in The Way to Win about what happened to John Kerry last time. Real question in the minds of some Democrats before his botched joke about whether Kerry had learned the lesson. And he went around saying to people, I've learned, I understand, I'll do better next time. I think that botched joke, However the freak show distorted it, whatever you think of what he intended to say, the way he handled himself afterwards, I think, has given Democrats quadruple pause about whether they'd like to trust him with the nomination.
And
again,
the heart of the John Kerry problem, as you assess it?
Well, Jack may feel differently, but he lost control of his public image. He didn't understand. He broke a series of trade secrets. So, first off, I still don't know if John Kerry knows if he threw his own medals or someone else's. I still don't know if John Kerry thought he was in Cambodia on Christmas Eve. I still don't know if John Kerry knows what anti-war protests he attended, what meetings he attended, and what was said there. A series of factual questions about his past, about his voting record, about whether he voted for it before he voted against it, which a candidate must know, must be able to explain before the country and the party will give you a chance to make your case for why you should be president.
On the other hand, there's policy and what you'd do with the country. I wanted to ask you about a point you make. You look at all the changes in the media, the lack of the sort of referee or governor that leaves the freak show going on, and you say the cumulative effect of these incentives and the actions they inspire is a political system constantly staggering toward the irrational. Now, that's a scary observation if it's true. What do you mean? Do we have irrational policy, politics? Why irrational out of this?
Well, because the process now is controlled, as we talked about earlier, the center of our process now controlled by these extreme, eccentric voices. If Matt Drudge put up on the Drudge Report right now, Hillary Clinton's been seeing a therapist, mental health treatment for over a year. Every news organization in the country, including, dare I say it, NPR, would have their reporters calling up Hillary Clinton's people saying, is this true? Will she deny it? Is she getting mental health treatment? Would find its way onto talk radio, would find its way onto cable TV, and then that would become a story in and of itself.
But does it overwhelm our national leaders, or would be leaders? Does it leave us with crazy candidates?
It leaves us with a process in which those extreme voices of Rush Limbaugh, Matt Drudge, Michael Moore are central to what people learn about their candidates. You can overcome that if you handle it skillfully, but it is what currently drives, in the weakness of the old media, the rising strength of the new media, it's currently what drives the narrative in presidential politics. I wish it weren't that way. John and I are deploring this, but it is, as we have covered presidential campaigns, this is what we see. And again, if you want to know the way to win for your candidate, or if you're a candidate yourself, you've got to understand what happened to Kerry, what happened to Gore, what happened to Hillary Clinton's opponent in the Senate race this year, to understand how politics is now played by the winners.
Does it make a difference, though, if the American people get kind of sobered up by how tough reality is getting out there? Does the public become less open to the kind of freak show, endless babble?
I hope so. I hope old media news organizations and even some new media ones read the book and say, you know what, we need to do better. We need to have these extreme voices perhaps out there as part of the symphony, but not at the center of how we learn about presidential campaigns. And we need candidates who will stand up to the freak show. We know that the winner in 2008 will have to deal with the freak show and will probably be the one who deals with it most skillfully. That's unfortunate. It should be about something else than that.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Gary's on the line. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom, and it's a thrill to listen to these both of these gentlemen, because I've read some of their work and I really like them. The question I have is, there seems to be a curse of the front runner among the Democrats. It seems in the last couple of election cycles that the Republican front runner, the presumptive front runner, has coasted right into the position in time for the general election. But we have watched one after another presumptive front runner in the Democratic Party just get knocked off early. I mean, the perfect example is John Kerry knocking off Howard Dean in the Iowa election. Why does that happen among Democrats a good deal more than it does among Republicans?
Gary, let us pick it up. Mark Halperin?
Well, Republicans, you're right, have done a more disciplined job of nominating their front runner. But, you know, John Kerry was the front runner for a time. And, of course, Al Gore was the front runner in 2000, Walter Mondale in 84. So Democrats also seem to favor the front runner. The reason why Hillary Clinton and John McCain are so strong is because they have the capacity to raise money. But if you look at a John Edwards, potentially a Barack Obama, or Mitt Romney, they are in a position to compete with these front runners. And the Democrats' front runner is Hillary Clinton. It's not always best to nominate the front runner. We'll have to see. But the Democratic Party certainly, you're right, is not as consistently picked the person who a year out or 18 months out even was considered the front runner.
Let's take a call from Raleigh, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi. First, I'd like to thank you and your guests for talking about this. You know, for political junkies like me, this has been a fantastic week. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the Democratic blogging community, where what I've been seeing lately is a tremendous amount of backing for Al Gore and Wesley Clark, and conversely, a fear on the part of a lot of people, myself included, that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee and that she'll lose the race for us. So I'm interested in your guest take on this, and I'll take my answer off the air.
John, thanks for your call. Mark Halperin, Gore, Clark, and the Democratic bloggers, Netroots, and for that matter, the Republican blogosphere.
Right. Well, the Democratic blogosphere is certainly a player in Democratic politics. Some people, I think some of my colleagues, think they're a bigger player already than they've been. They certainly have proven that they can pass opinions around. They've proven in some cases they can raise money. They do not like Hillary Clinton, and her people know that. One of the steps they've taken in the last year is to try to figure out a way to defuse the blogosphere. Hillary Clinton endorsing Ned Lamont in the Connecticut Senate race over Joe Lieberman.
Well, they don't like Hillary because they see Hillary as too centrist, too conservative.
Particularly on the war. But, you know, the Democratic blogosphere is an interesting, if you try to get a sense of what they care about. They care a lot about being against the war. They care a lot about liberal positions in some cases, but a lot of them seem to care about winning. And I think as they start to look at these national polls, sure, based a lot on name ID, but Hillary Clinton, we argue in the way to win, has learned a lot about how to run for president. She went through two campaigns with her husband. She studied the Bush-Rove model a lot. And I think she will make more inroads within the blogosphere as she finesses the war issue. I think she'll do that. As she reaches out more to these bloggers if she becomes a candidate. And again, I think some of these bloggers who say they care about winning might be able to be convinced that she can make this a choice election rather than a referendum on her and have a chance to win. But there are other candidates out there who they certainly are more attracted to currently.
What about Al Gore, John asks?
May well run. You know, my prediction is that he'll win an Academy Award next year for An Inconvenient Truth. And if he's going to run, he'll do it up at the microphone. Thank you to my agent and to all the people. And I'm running for president.
Are you serious?
Well, yeah. It'd be a good chance to do it. You get a lot of free publicity that way. He could run, and I think he'd be in some ways a strong candidate. My gut tells me that if Hillary Clinton is in this race, that he will not enter, that he wants to be anointed. And with Barack Obama, with John Edwards showing a fair amount of strength, if they enter the race, I don't think he'll have an easy path to nomination. And I think he recognizes that getting in the fray now would be a risk, and I don't think it's a risk he'll take.
Wesley Clark? Another name? Can come back?
Maybe. You know, it's an interesting field. After Clinton, Obama, and Edwards, there's about eight guys, they're all guys, who I think could make a claim that they might be in the fray. Wes Clark, Joe Biden, Evan Bayh, Bill Richardson, Tom Vilsack, Chris Dodd. These are all serious people, all with a lot of experience, a much deeper field than the Republicans have. It'll be interesting to see, again, it's an unfortunate reality, how many of them have raised $12 million by June. If you've not raised $12 million by June of next year, if you're Wes Clark, it's going to be difficult to be treated seriously going forward. You can do it, but no one's ever been nominated with that kind of strategy in either party.
Let's go to John in Washington, D.C. Hi, John. You're on the air with Mark Halperin.
Yes, you mentioned confront your weaknesses, and I don't think Bush did that at all. I think he avoided the abortion issue. He avoided the He said that's already been decided. That's hardly true, but he avoided the issue. He avoided his National Guard service issue. He was avoiding issues rather than confronting issues.
Mark Halperin, what about it? On his way into the freak show, George Bush confronting or avoiding, or, you know, how did he keep the lid on?
Right. Well, you raised some interesting ones. The things I think he confronted were education. You know, in 1996, the Republican Party platform said the Department of Education should be abolished. In 2000, Bush said there should be no child left behind administered by the Department of Education. Bush ran for president saying, my party is trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. He reached out in some ways on the issues of abortion and gay rights, not as much as some liberals would like, but he reached out in some ways on those issues. He also reached out to African-American voters, to Hispanic voters, again, in ways that weren't all that effective in 2000, but he did try to reach out. In terms of his past, again, this is a tactical, mechanical thing. He knew about his past. He knew about his draft record. Didn't know everything, but he knew more about it than Bill Clinton seemed to know about his own draft record when he ran in 1992.
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, and I think that there's a substantial record here of the press not doing its job on him. I mean, there are the incidents, the whole National Guard story, for example, barely got the coverage it deserved in 2000. It was on the front page of the Boston Globe and then pretty much disappeared. The near conflict of interest or insider trading with Harkin Energy, which looks awfully suspicious today even, that got none of the attention it deserved. When Bush was asked had he used marijuana or drugs. He basically just didn't say we don't have any answer for that at all. And I think this is telling this and the other thing was the dynamic, and as these gentlemen show in their book, the reporters who were covering Al Gore, for the one for the New York Times, Kit Seeley, and C.C. Connolly for the Washington Post, really shouldn't be working today. They covered him so poorly. They asserted things about Bush, about Gore, that Gore had said that he had not said, and that others showed them he had not said. And yet they said, oh, no, that's the line on Bush, on Gore, that he said he invented the Internet. He did not. And people who were at the same event where he was alleged to have said that said he did not. And yet they kept going. And what I'm pointing out here is that there's that the lack of responsibility in the press corps in that example, the hard line on Gore and then the easy line on Bush, I think it gives the lie to this notion that somehow there's a liberal bias in the media. What there really is a kind of majoritarian bias, and also allowing these reporters to pretty much, in some cases, make it up.
So there it is. But Mark Halpern, you go into political battle, to quote a recently departed or paraphrase, with the media you've got.
Yeah. Jack, I agree with almost everything you just said there. And we write about a lot of those things in the book. The disparity in the coverage between Gore and Bush in 2000, one of the great failings, I think, of media coverage during my career. I can't endorse your asking two of my friends and colleagues to lose their jobs, because I think they're good reporters, but they were part of a process that was unfair. And, you know, there's a lot of debate, and we take it on in the way to win, about whether the press is liberally biased or not. There's all sorts of biases in the press. There's all sorts of weaknesses in the old media that I think are really harming American democracy. One of the problems, even if you don't want to believe the press is liberally biased, is for 40 years conservatives have felt that way. They still do. Liberals feel we were too tough on Gore, too easy on Bush. Both those things can be true. And as a country, if we want a strong democracy, we need a strong media that's respected and trusted. We've got to work and through and discuss all these problems and not let them become part of a freak show debate where every piece of information is a weapon or a shield. It should be about working this out, discussing it, and coming up with some truth.
Let's get one more call. Gene from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I agree with what Mark was saying, that the media need to be strong and respected. But I think so far what I'm hearing, including from you, Mark, is that the media are just falling into the same trap they did last time around. For instance, is the press really doing its job when it says right now Mitt Romney is one of the strongest candidates, especially compared to John McCain? Well, maybe in terms of the money, maybe in terms of the name, but are we ever, I mean, when do we start looking at the issues if we don't start looking at them now, and what any candidate's record is, not just his record alone? In other words, the media are part of who can drive the narrative, drive the issues. And from what I saw, for instance, in the press conference on Kerry's botched joke, it looked to me like the media were just falling exactly into the spin of the administration.
And Gene, our time grows short, but Mark Halpern, how about it? Do you see what the American people asking for and therefore maybe getting a different kind of coverage?
If you're on the right side of the digital divide, there's more information about candidates and campaigns than there's ever been in the history of the world. The trick is, the question is, does the country demand a seriousness from the old media, from the dominant media, and does it reject the freak show media that covers things in terms of which tribe you're in? We'll see. We'd like there to be an economic model. At ABC News and The Washington Post, we'd love there to be an economic model where covering issues, covering seriousness, kept us in business. We've got to hope that the consumers are there. And now, to give away the end of the book, John and I believe that the way to win long-term in American politics is for the people to demand a seriousness and a lack of partisanship and attack. Unfortunately, the political players and the media players, every incentive they have in the freak show is to attack. That is the kind of politics we have for 2008, unless there's a different set of incentives brought to us by voters and readers and listeners.
Well, we may have seen a different set of sentiments expressed just last week. We'll see how the candidates interpret that when they begin to hit the stage. No question, we'll see freak show underway as well. Mark Halpern, co-author with John Harris of the new book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. There you go. Mark Halpern, thanks for being with us.
Thanks. The book's website, thewaytowin2008.com, if you want to read more.
Jack Beatty, sun coming up on a new campaign, if not a new day, maybe both.
Oh, my gosh, I'm exhausted already.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks, Jack. This is On Point.